Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Unless you were a film buff and paid close attention to who made Hollywood movies, you may not have known much about Harvey Weinstein until last October. Today, Weinstein is a household name after allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment were made against Weinstein by dozens of women. After the Weinstein allegations surfaced, other men were accused of improper sexual conduct, and thousands of women said they were victims of assault or harassment by using the hashtag MeToo on social media. MeToo changed the culture. Women and men who stayed quiet for years spoke out. 6 months later, Bucknell University's Institute for Public Policy has commissioned a nationwide survey on attitudes toward the Me Too movement, and it's the topic of our discussion today. Joining us is Karen Baker, Chief Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape and the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. Ms. Baker, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also joining us is Chris Ellis, Associate Professor of Political Science at Bucknell University and Director of the Bucknell Survey Research Laboratory. Professor Ellis, welcome to the show as well.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, we'd like to hear your opinions on this topic. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You could leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, I'll repeat that phone number slowly because we are during our spring fundraising campaign where there is another 800 number. And if you have a comment or a question for Smart Talk, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Chris Ellis, let me turn to you. What do the results of this survey say to you? What's the takeaway?
So what we're I think what we're finding is basically two things. One is that this movement is sort of, it's become, for better or worse, it's become a political divide, right? That we see that Democrats, regardless of gender, think that this thing is good and it's helpful and it's moving people in the right direction. It's empowering people to come forward. We see that Republicans, regardless of gender, tend to think that it's gone too far, right? And tend to think that it's sort of punished, its lasting influence is going to be to punish people for things that they haven't done, right? So we've seen that this movement is sort of mapped onto the culture war in ways that you know, may be obvious in retrospect, but it certainly didn't seem like that's where this started, right? You mentioned Harvey Weinstein, and that was sort of a very obvious case, but at this point, this movement has sort of become political in ways that maybe it shouldn't, or maybe it wasn't going to, but it has, right? And the second thing we sort of find is that we also see kind of ambivalence about what its lasting effects are going to be. So most people think that this is going to change workplace policies. Most people think it's going to sort of make people more likely to come forward with allegations of harassment. But there's also some ambivalence of whether this is actually going to do anything to stop harassment, right? And so we kind of have, one, a political fight, and second, a sort of ambivalence about what the lasting consequences are going to be.
I know you didn't ask this question, but maybe an observation in context with the survey. But for those who view Me Too unfavorably or feel that it has gone too far, when did they start feeling that way? Was there a time when they said that, okay, we've heard a lot about this, but now it has gone too far?
Well, we didn't ask, so the survey is fairly recent, so we didn't get the very beginning. But if I were to guess, right, I think what's happening is at the beginning it was sort of a, oh my God, these people did these terrible things, and so this sort of becomes the national story. And then after that, it becomes kind of essentially a proxy, at least in sort of my reading of it, for other kinds of cultural fights that we're having, right? So it becomes sort of a proxy for, you know, gender dynamics and, you know, the relationship of workers and managers and all sorts of other things. So I think given where our politics is now, it was sort of inevitable that this is going to be swept up into that. But certainly over the past 3 or 4 months, we've seen this become not just a gender issue or a sexual harassment issue or a sexual assault issue, but very much a political issue.
So, and just to clarify that a little bit more or talk about a little bit more, we are in a divided country along partisan lines very often. So you just see this as another example of shots being fired in that cultural war.
Well, that was the thing that sort of surprised me the most about this, is that not that this has become political, because we sort of assume that it was, but divides in perceptions over Me Too are bigger than partisan divides over immigration or taxes or healthcare or whatever. So it seems like this issue is in some ways perfectly set up to be sort of a way to fight the culture wars. And so we've seen divides on this happen really quickly and seem to be fairly lasting at this point.
Karen Baker, I'll start the same with you, the same question that I asked Chris Ellis. What's your takeaway on the results of this survey?
Well, I think it's a very interesting snapshot in time. I think back to 1991 when Anita Hill first told her story, and the vast majority of the country did not believe her. Nevertheless, laws changed, more people came forward and started reporting, and I see this survey as indicating some positive movement, although clearly there is a divide. I also wonder about that political divide, whether people are reacting to the name of the movement and how that has been sort of has become a shorthand and been attached to other deeper things. But the people I talk to, when I really drill down and talk about the behaviors, I don't find much difference in Republicans and Democrats about, do you want your sons and daughters to be safe and free from sexual harassment when they go to college, when they go to the military, when they go into the workplace? I'm not seeing much difference when we actually talk about the issues rather than the label.
And that is something when you think about it in a literal sense. If you sit down with someone, and I don't care what party they're affiliated with, how political they are, maybe they don't care about politics whatsoever, you ask them that question point blank, if they've witnessed or have been the target of sexual harassment, maybe even sexual assault in the workplace, if they've witnessed it, if they know someone, almost everyone answers yes. So, and that's where the Me Too movement kind of grew out of. So you're saying that you think the label itself, hashtag Me Too, is part of the reason that there is this divide.
Well, I think that's the piece that has become politicized through sound bites. But I think the movement itself is having a very positive effect. I know a lot of people are, both men and women, are feeling more comfortable telling their story and are more likely to be believed. I talked to one man who said that he had worked in this field for a long time and he knew the statistics, but it wasn't until he saw on his own Facebook page all of his friends and acquaintances that said Me Too, that's when he really got it, and it made a real emotional difference for him. So I think it's bringing it home for people.
Professor Ellis, what about that, the label Me Too?
Yeah, so I think the label is sort of, again, reflective of some of these deeper divides, right? I think the label is something easy we can sort of, you know, become attached to or hate or something like that. But I think what the label sort of suggests is trying to understand what Me Too actually means. So we have other data that suggests that we have very different, across, again, political divides and other divides, very different definitions of what sexual harassment actually is, right? And so we ask some questions about, you know, is giving someone a hug unsolicited sexual harassment? Is talking to someone in a sexually suggestive way sexual harassment? And so I think we're also seeing not just kind of a reckoning for the obvious, like Harvey Weinstein cases, but sort of a divide over, okay, what actually is inappropriate, what doesn't make sense, what is bad for the workplace? And that's where I think a lot of the political clashes come from, right? I don't think anyone is, I can't imagine a coalition that is like pro-sexual harassment or whatever, but I think we have differences on what exactly that constitutes, and so some of these discussions were suppressed, and now we're having them in the open, and so I think that's where a lot of the political divide comes from.
Karen, I want to ask this question just as Chris brought it up. How is sexual harassment defined and even sexual assault? Because, and can I just add something? I mean, when we have talked about sexual assault in the past, a statistic that is used most often is that one in three women have been the victim of sexual assault in their lifetimes, maybe one in five men. And there always is a question about, okay, what is the definition of sexual assault? So how would you define sexual harassment and sexual assault?
That's a very good question, Scott. And I think these types of words and labels are very confusing. And they're also why our statistics vary, because definitions and behaviors are described differently. At the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape, we define sexual harassment and sexual violence very broadly to include any type of unwanted verbal or physical action. And I think it's at that lower level that Chris was talking about where there's a lot of confusion or disagreement. You know, is telling a sexual joke or story or making a sexist comment at work, is that sexual harassment? Legally, it might not rise to the level of sexual harassment, but what we know is that it's on a continuum of behaviors that, if left unchecked or if tolerated in the workplace, can lead to more serious behaviors. And so we really like for people to intervene early and set a culture where those types of things aren't tolerated.
And Chris Ellis, something that the poll did show is that overwhelmingly, I mean, it's over 90% that the Me Too movement will lead to stricter definitions of sexual harassment in the workplace. So that is a real positive that has come out of this.
Yeah, so I think, so everyone agreed on that, right? That workplaces, whether this actually turns out to be true, but at least people perceive that it's going to be true, that definitions are going to change. Where we differ again is whether, where people in the public differ again, is whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, right? And so, again, sort of people on the left tend to say, okay, look, that there really is some deeper, broader issue that might not necessarily mean a legal sexual harassment problem, but also sort of makes workplaces uncomfortable or violent or just difficult to be in. And people on the right, again, tend to sort of think that, okay, what this is doing is then it's just sort of, it's stifling conversation, right? It's stifling workplace environments in ways that are not necessary. And so the one finding that sort of pointed to this is the idea of mentorship, right? And so there is a political divide, slightly a gender divide, but a political divide over whether Me Too will lead to people being less likely to want to mentor young women in the workplace. And I'm not entirely sure what to make of that, but saying that, look, if we're redefining things to say that anything that might be kind of accidentally, you know, offensive or whatever is harassment, then Republicans tend to think, or conservatives tend to think, that, look, what this does is it sort of, it would make men more likely to just say, you know what, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to bother because it's going to be a problem for me, or could potentially be a problem for me. And that's where things kind of, I think, get, again, not political, but sort of that's where the divide comes in, right? That if we're sort of redefining things to be stricter, then what other effects does that have? And again, politically, we sort of differ on what those effects are likely to be.
Ms. Baker, your take on that?
Well, I think it's unfortunate if it has the effect of shutting people down and shutting down conversations. I think actually the opposite is intended. I think that this is a wonderful opportunity to open up conversations in the workplace, to have these discussions, to say, you know, I was just thinking about that joke I told last week, and I'd just like to check with you, was that offensive? It doesn't have to be a punitive atmosphere. I think it should be an open atmosphere that invites discussion, invites people to share their feelings. And that in and of itself sets a climate of safety and respect.
Professor Ellis, yeah. About half of the respondents viewed Me Too favorably, but it was only 41%. 21% viewed it unfavorably. That means 38% didn't know, didn't have an opinion where they hadn't heard of it, and very few, according to the overall figures, hadn't heard of Me Too. It was overwhelmingly, it was like 81%. So that 38% figure is intriguing or fascinating. I wonder whether there are people there that were afraid to ask or answer the question. What was your take on that?
Yeah, so I think that there's two ways to interpret this, right? That I think, one, people were sort of afraid to give their opinion because they didn't want to, as you said, sort of express support or opposition to someone that's talking to them on the phone. I also think that we sort of maybe overstate, and this isn't just a Me Too thing, but this is a politics thing in general, how deep this sort of stuff filters into the American public. That we found that roughly 20% of people had never heard of this movement before, which is fascinating to me because as someone who follows the news all the time, it's everywhere, right? And I think we see this kind of in universities, we see it in Hollywood, as you mentioned, we see it in sort of major news organizations, but I think sort of for, you know, regular working class people who are just doing regular jobs, this is not filtered down. And again, I'm not sure what to make of that, but it's not. I don't think it's as broadly supported or broadly opposed as a movement as you might think, because there's lots of workplaces where this is just not filtered down to yet.
And I'm going to, you know, there are only a few other parts of the survey, so I don't want to get bogged down in sure. A lot of the numbers, but want to talk about whether it's gone too far. That was a question that was asked, whether the Me Too movement had gone too far. 47% of men thought so, compared to 34% of women. Karen Baker, what do you think of that, those results?
Well, I think that the people who think that it's gone too far are worried about being, you know, falsely accused or having overly punitive consequences. And I think that's something that we really need to look at, and I don't think a lot of businesses have totally figured out. There really can't be just one answer. You know, not everyone who does anything along this continuum we talked about should be fired necessarily, right? There's other things that you can do. You can do training, you can talk to someone, you can change their shift, all kinds of things. And if we get a broader range of consequences, I think that will help take some of the fear.
Mm-hmm. Professor Ellis, your take on that? I mean, obviously, when we dig down a little bit further, a big partisan divide on this one, too.
Yeah, and so again, you mentioned the gender divide, but again, the partisan divide was pretty big, right? So 2/3 of Republican women thought that Me Too had gone too far. And maybe that, again, that's just sort of like reflexively going back to this is what my tribe thinks. But it's not just this, and we sort of see this in other places too, it's sort of how campuses deal with sexual assault and allegations of harassment and you know, the changing Title IX guidelines that are going to come out in the next month or two. Basically, it's the balancing sort of, okay, people aren't coming forward with allegations because they don't think they'll be believed, with this idea of, you know, let's provide some due process rights, let's provide some opportunity to defend themselves for people who are accused, right? And so we've been sort of talking about this on campuses for years, and now it's sort of filtered into the workplace. And as was just mentioned, right, workplaces are sort of groping around trying to figure out exactly what to do with this, right? And sort of in the interim, before we can find some kind of balance between letting people defend themselves and also taking accusers seriously, we're sort of going to be in this kind of this middle of the road political divide where I either want to believe all people that are accusing or I want to provide due process rights. And so there's just a lot of stuff that needs to be hashed out, and we're sort of now having these discussions which we haven't had before.
We have a lot more to talk about. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We are in the midst of WITF's spring fundraising campaign. I'm joined by WITF's Multimedia News Director, Tim Lambert. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Scott. Great to be here. A beautiful day. A little cold, but, you know.
It's spring.
It snow flurries yesterday.
I know.
And then 76 on Friday.
I know.
Well, look, I just want to throw the forecast. I give up. I can't even read this anymore. It's ridiculous.
I know.
So, but it is another day of our spring fundraising campaign. Had a great morning during Morning Edition. We want to keep the momentum going through Smart Talk, of course. And we have a goal of $400 to reach by 10 o'clock. And we hope that you'll help us reach that goal, of course, by making a contribution of $10 a month, $20 a month, maybe a one-time contribution of $120 or $1 a day, and support the programming, support the conversations that you hear each and every day on Smart Talk that Scott brings you, fascinating conversations about different topics, whether it's an author, whether it is about an important issue, important to your community. We are here for you each and every day, and we hope that you'll support the programming financially right now at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
You know, Tim, there's a school of thought that when we are pledging, when we are fundraising, that we do lighter topics. I don't happen to believe. I'm not part of that school of thought. I think that what we do is what we do with a typical day. And the Me Too movement and what has transpired in this country over the past 6 months, I think it's such an important topic, but it's a good example of the kind of topics that we address every day on Smart Talk. And I think that you out there appreciate that. And if you do, that's why we're asking for your financial support.
And what's so interesting, too, is that you're delving into the issue. It's not becoming this cartoonish back and forth that you see on social media sometimes about, you know, the folks who are just taking things out of context or just picking one piece of evidence and throwing it out there. This is about looking deeper and deeper into an issue and its importance in the workplace, in school, in society. And so it's important to take that deeper look. And if that's what you want from a media organization, especially one that's locally owned and operated, we hope that you'll support Smart Talk right now with a contribution of $10 a month, of $20 a month, of $100 a month at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483. What we do best is provide context.
Context, and we do it in a thoughtful, civil way. And it's not just Smart Talk, but everything that we do on WITF, whether it's news, whether it's the weekend programs, everything is designed to be thoughtful. It's designed to be balanced. It's designed that it will be presented in a civil way. As you suggested, Tim, so many people, and, you know, we're talking about a divide here, a partisan divide, you know, a cultural war, if you will, with some of these issues. But we're not doing it in a way that people are yelling back and forth. We're trying to bring that context to it, and that's what we do all the time on WITF.
Yeah, it's very important to do that. I mean, we help everybody shape their own opinions about issues that affect their lives. It's, we don't tell you how to think. We don't tell you how to feel. We present the facts. We present the context. And it's up to you to make that decision. If you want to read another organization's reporting, you can do that as well. We encourage that. You should have a diverse group of voices that you rely on and a diverse group of organizations. But we hope that WITF is at the center of that for you. And if it is, we hope that you'll support it financially when we come to you like we do now during our fundraising campaign. At WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
Tim Lambert, WITF's Multimedia News Director. Talk to you in a few minutes, Tim.
Sure.
And if you're just tuning in, I think that it is a good idea, because I've run into this in the past, because we do have two 800 numbers when we are fundraising, that if you'd like to join in the Smart Talk conversation, and we'd like to hear from you today talking about the Me Too movement, 1-800-729-7532. Our guests during this portion of the program are Chris Ellis, Associate Professor of Political Science at Bucknell University and Director of the Bucknell University Survey Research Laboratory, and Karen Baker, Chief Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape and the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. Bucknell recently put out a survey, a nationwide poll on the Me Too movement, and we're talking about some of the results. It's going to lead into a conversation about just what Me Too has done in this country over the last 6 months. But again, we'd like to hear your opinions. Me Too, gone too far? What do you think it's done? Your observations. Has it changed your thinking about your workplace or how you deal with the members of the opposite sex? 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Karen Baker, here's some of the observations that I think can be made as the result of Me Too. Women feel more comfortable in coming forward and talking about the experiences that they've had. And also, they are more likely to be believed. Your thoughts on those two things?
I think those are absolutely...
Hold on just 1 second. Let me get you back on the air. There we go.
Thank you, Scott. I think those are absolutely true and absolutely essential. You know, at the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape, we're working to ultimately prevent all types of sexual harassment and sexual abuse. Part of that is how we treat current survivors. Another part of that is how we hold people accountable who are doing offending behaviors. And then another part is looking at our culture. But believing survivors is the first step, because that sends a message to other people who have not yet told their story, or to people who might be considering causing some harm. It just sends a message that this is not tolerated. It's not acceptable. We can do better.
Another narrative that we've heard is the number or the large percentage of people coming forward to say they have been harassed or assaulted, especially women, that it's no surprise. I mean, even those who may have an unfavorable view of Me Too will admit that they know this has been going on for some time. Everyone knows that it's been happening, but Me Too gave those coming forward strength, or those who have been quiet up until now or up until Me Too gave them strength.
Absolutely. There's a lot of good reasons why people don't come forward or don't come forward right away, but it's very empowering to witness other people doing so and to have them be believed. One thing I want to mention, too, a lot of the people that are coming forward, I know we're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace a lot today, but a lot of people coming forward in Me Too are talking about experiences that happened to them as children. So April is both Sexual Assault Awareness Month, but it's also Child Abuse Prevention Month. And so I just want to highlight the fact that a lot of this is what's happening to our children. And hopefully we can all agree, regardless of our political party, that this really must stop.
Professor Ellis, and this may not be a question that was on the survey, but what we just talked about with Karen Baker about women especially being believed, is that something that from the results of this poll, this survey, yet do you think that women are more likely to be believed as a result of Me Too?
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think that's true. And I think, the political divide is whether that's a good thing or not. But I think absolutely that is true, right? That we sort of, we're now much more likely to believe allegations when they come forward as opposed to sort of, the things we've done before, either sweeping things under the rug or whatnot. And so I think, that is absolutely true. What people are sort of perhaps concerned about is, okay, if we just sort of start with, a de facto assumption that people are being believed, then what does that mean for the justice system? What does it mean for due process? And so workplaces are trying to figure this out. The law is trying to figure this out. My research is on Title IX at universities. Universities are trying to figure this out. So how do we sort of balance this idea that we've been sweeping this under the rug for a really long time with the idea that, look, maybe we need to put the brakes on just believing every allegation without investigating it a little bit. And I think that's where a lot of the sort of ambivalence comes from about the movement.
Karen, that is one of the topics that I want to discuss today, and that is that due process, two words that you probably have heard more over the past 6 months than in the 6 years before. But this is one of the criticisms of Me Too, for those who will criticize it, is that when, even though there are women, especially women, who are being believed more so than what they were before Me Too, that the men who are accused have not gotten their day in court, so to speak, have not gotten due process. Mm-hmm. Many of them right away have lost their jobs, or their reputations have been besmirched. What about that as part of all this? Mm-hmm.
Well, in some of the most egregious cases, or when there's multiple victims, I think that's absolutely warranted. But there's many other situations where the behavior is, perhaps it's not proven, or perhaps it's a lower level. I think part of our problem is we don't have enough solutions yet. We need to go beyond criminal justice for sure. But even in the workplace, we shouldn't just jump to firing. And I think a lot of people might be surprised to know that many victims do not want these things either. In fact, if the only solution at a workplace is someone's going to be fired if they're accused, that also prohibits people from reporting. Victims may not want to come forward. I may not want my coworker to be fired. I may just want them to stop doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that we have limited solutions is harmful to both people who are accused and to people who are victims.
All right, so limited solutions. Go a little bit farther, if you will. What kind of solutions?
We need to have a whole range of solutions. I think the business, of course, they have their reputation, so they want to communicate that they're taking the issue seriously. But taking it seriously could be multiple things. It could be requiring someone to receive counseling or training, or changing their work location or their work hours if there needs to be some separation from a particular person. Then, of course, if these things are tried and they don't work, then I think firing may be warranted. But I don't think it should be the first thing, or definitely not the only thing.
This has been the issue on college campuses for a long time, right? On one hand, you can't sort of trust the criminal justice system to handle these cases because, one, it's really slow. Two, as was mentioned, people don't necessarily want someone to go to jail for what they've done. And three, it's you know, we have people living literally next door to each other, and so you can't sort of just have a criminal solution when there's also a residential aspect. But on the other hand, then people have sort of said, well, the processes that colleges use have not provided opportunities for people to defend themselves, right? There's no cross-examination, and it's sort of difficult to present the evidence that you might have if you think you're innocent. And so we've been sort of groping around with this for a long time, right, trying to sort of figure out, okay, we have a situation where it's very difficult for people to come forward. They might not want to do the full criminal penalty aspect of it. But at the same time, in overreaching, then perhaps we've deprived people of the right to defend themselves, right? And so, you know, again, trying to sort of find this happy medium solutions is really hard.
But Professor Ellis, one thing that I would like to point out, and you're well aware of this, that college campuses have probably, and college administrations have probably been the worst offenders historically at many college campuses. I'm not talking about Bucknell, but talking about college campuses overall across this country, where a woman has come forward, I don't know whether you say typical, but what many people envision, the party where there's some drinking, something occurs, it's a he said, she said situation, and that sometimes college administrators have questioned that woman and said, do you really want to follow through with this? Or that they don't follow through and don't take it seriously. So college campuses have been one of the worst offenders. Maybe your only observation can be from Bucknell, but is that changing? Did Me Too change the attitudes amongst college administrators?
So I think, well, among college administrators, I can't speak for them. So what changed for colleges, I think, was the Obama administration's new directive to try to change how, force colleges to change how they deal with sexual harassment and sexual assault issues, right? And so this was a mid-2010 thing that said, look, one, you have to, there's going to be a college is going to be held to a higher standard, so we can't sweep things under the rugs anymore. And two, we're going to sort of mandate that colleges provide a different level of adjudicating sexual assault cases that are not consistent with criminal law, right? It's easier to punish people because you're not putting people in jail. The worst penalty is expulsion. And so this is sort of what colleges are doing, because you're absolutely right. I mean, they've been, we see examples now, right down the road at Penn State or Baylor or Michigan State, where colleges have just, swept things under the rug or tried not to pay attention to them or whatever. And now we're sort of having the concerns of overreach, right? We've had about something like 100 colleges, little less than 100 colleges that have lost lawsuits to students who thought that their due process rights were violated in sexual assault cases. And so we're sort of trying to, we pushed in one direction, and then we're sort of pushing back in the other direction and trying to sort of figure out exactly what a fair process looks like.
Karen, what's your observations as far as college campuses? We've talked a lot about the workplace today,
right?
But what about college campuses? Have you seen any change since Me Too?
I agree with Chris that we've seen change since the, It's on Us and the emphasis on Title IX, and probably Me Too also is contributing to that. But as we strive for balance and due process, which I definitely do believe in, I just want to make sure that people understand that in the absence of that, or while we're waiting to figure out what due process is, many victims are dropping out of school, or they are really taking the brunt of the issue because nothing else is happening. And so we just need to put things in place that will support the victims and allow them to continue their education. Also, we know that some of the people who are accused seem to have more resources for attorneys and things such as that, are more likely to press lawsuits. So I think that causes the pendulum to swing in another direction, and we need to use kind of social norms and just appealing to people to do the right thing to keep that balance coming from the other side so that victims can can remain in college.
A bottom line question, are conditions better on campus? Are women, and some men too, and I want to make sure that we don't leave men out, but it is majority of women who are the victims of harassment or sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Are conditions better that women are safer on college campuses?
I think they are on many college campuses. It varies, of course, because it all comes down to the particular policies, the climate, and how the policies are enforced, and the people that are involved in enforcing them. But I think it is better on many college campuses. We still have a long ways to go.
I want to switch gears now and talk about the past. And I'm not talking about in a legal sense here with this question, but there's no time limit on rape. Actually, there is in Pennsylvania. That has been one of the issues that many people have been fighting for, is to lift the statute of limitations or at least change the statute of limitation laws on sexual assault in this state. But I'm talking in a non-literal sense that many people will look at a rape much differently than they would, say, how some things are defined as sexual assault or sexual harassment. But the question I'm getting to is there a time limit? A man that did something 20 years ago that he hasn't repeated, or there hasn't been part of his life in the workplace or other places as well. Now he may be sorry for that. How far back do we go as far as, because we know there have been cases, some high-profile men, that it's gone back 10, 20 years, even further than that. How far do we go back?
Yeah, and you're not talking legally here. You're just talking,
no.
Right. Well, I think for a victim who's coming forward and telling a story about something that happened many years ago, she or he may not know whether that has continued or not. But to me, I think it makes a big difference whether the person owns up to their behavior and attempts to apologize for it. And, you know, maybe, you know, they educate themselves. Maybe they volunteer at their local rape crisis center. I think there are things that people can do that really help us understand, you know, they're different now, and they are sorry for that. And so, yeah, we can move on. But it might not be clear. And a person often is motivated to tell their story much later because they start worrying about, are other people being victimized by this person? And if I would have spoken, could I have stopped that? And maybe I could stop that now. So that's often a motivation for people speaking out.
Does the severity of the action have an impact on whether, you know, someone should be have a pointed finger, a finger pointed at them or not?
Well, I definitely think that should be a factor. However, it's difficult from a victim's point of view to say what's more severe than something else. I mean, people react differently to different things, and some things that people might think were less severe could have long-term consequences and health consequences and mental health consequences. So part of it is we can look sort of objectively at the behavior, and part of it we have to look at the impact of that behavior as well and take that into consideration.
One thing that I have heard from men, I've read about men who have said this, is that the Me Too movement has created some confusion in their minds. I'm going to give some examples here. Dating. Does one ask if the other wants to kiss or hold hands or put an arm around the other person?
Yes.
That a lot of times many men say they are confused as to what is appropriate, what's not appropriate. You said yes.
I think it's just always better to ask. And I think if we started this at a really young age, by the time people are dating, we would be more comfortable. So, you know, I have young grandchildren. I don't just automatically assume they want to run up and kiss me. I say, you know, can I have a hug? And, you know, maybe they don't want to. And I say, you know, oh, you want a hug or a high five or a wave? Giving people options, asking permission. If we just start becoming more comfortable with that, then by the time we're dating, it'll just be a little easier to say, hey, is it okay if I put my arm around you? I know that can be a little awkward, especially if people haven't practiced
that. It's not very romantic.
Well, another thing that people can do is just get really good at paying attention to the other person and reading body language. And, you know, you can start to put your arm around someone. If they pull away, then stop. So that's another way to do it. You can do it non-verbally, but you should always be checking with the other person. Do they want this? Or am I going a little too far and should I back off?
And, you know, I think that if we use the Hollywood, not a Harvey Weinstein movie, we won't talk about that. But if you use Hollywood movies as an example, and I think almost all of us have had this experience that the moment is just right where both people, you know, you decide that you're going to kiss. But you're saying that today the question should be asked.
Well, you know, I think sometimes it's really obvious that the other person is there too. So I just think some people make assumptions, or they assume that, you know, someone would want to kiss them, or that they're entitled to that kiss whether the person wants it or not. That's the kind of things we're really more concerned about.
When one person says no, okay, end of the line right there. I mean, that's, you don't pursue it, the other person doesn't pursue it. But is that the end of the date right there?
Well, that depends. I mean, that's up to the people. Say, hey, you know, are you ready to go home, or do you want to go out for some pizza? Again, I just think it's about communication. You know, and people have the right to change their minds. And, you know, just like it's not easy to ask the question, sometimes it's not easy to say no. So I think you really have to, you know, is there some hesitation here? If it's not an enthusiastic yes, then I think, you know, people should back off a little bit.
Should men be confused?
Well, Chris,
I'm going to get you in on this, too.
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Karen Wiggins.
Well, I think it's okay to be confused because that means we are reexamining things. And, you know, it's okay. Things change, and we all need to reexamine, you know, as we grow and learn. I certainly look at things differently now than I did, you know, when I was in college. I think that's healthy.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what were we going to say?
Oh, I was just going to... The difficulty becomes sort of translating a cultural practice to a legal practice, right? So, on college campuses, at least at Bucknell, we have the policy for sexual assault relates to something called affirmative consent, which means it's not no means no, it's yes means yes. And so, I mean, one, I look at that as like fundamentally inconsistent with how normal people behave in relationships. But two, also kind of provides this kind of confusion that's not just you should respect your partner, but also provides this kind of, well, if I don't get exactly the right word at exactly the right time, then that's I can be in trouble for that. It's not just I made a mistake or I made a bad decision, but I can actually be in trouble for that. I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes from. That I forget where it was, but there's a college somewhere where you get an app on your phone and you can sort of consent to sexual encounters via text message or via a point. And I think at that point we're sort of, I think we're trying to police something that's more cultural than it is legal.
So let's talk about, because we only have a few minutes left in the program, the future of Me Too. I mean, it is still going strong right now. And I think that most people will admit that it has made a change in our culture. Karen, how do you see the future of hashtag Me Too?
I'm encouraged. I think the more that this topic is out in the open, the better we will all handle it. And I also know that regardless of people's perceptions or individual people's behaviors, the culture of a workplace or a college or a faith community or anything makes a huge difference in how people are actually treated. So I find that hopeful.
We have a listener here who mentioned, shouldn't the parents and families become involved in the learning of sexual standards? And that's something...
Absolutely.
This is a discussion that not just talking about the biology of it, the birds and the bees, how babies are made, but at the same time, how members of the opposite sex, or if you were, you know, a same-sex couple, how that significant other is to be treated.
Exactly. I think it starts at that very young age with parents and coaches and teachers and anyone who influences young people, helping learn about boundaries and rules and reading body language and not invading someone's space or hurting someone's feelings or apologizing when you do, and all of those kinds of things really set the stage for for positive and healthy adult relationships.
So, Chris Ellis, I'm going to ask the same question I did right up front. Your takeaway, maybe what the audience can take away from what you learned in the survey.
I think what we learned is that we're sort of divided on this, right? That we have, you know, different views on what sexual harassment is. We have different views on what's appropriate, not appropriate. And so to the extent that that's the case, if we're talking about not just workplace policy, but policy, change is going to be really hard, because if you have a movement that only half of the country thinks is a good thing, then nothing will sort of change from a policy standpoint. And if that's the case, then it's also possible that very little will change from a cultural standpoint, or at least this will become a mark of division rather than a mark of moving forward. And so I don't know exactly what to make of that or exactly what the next step is, but the division is real, and it's not necessarily a gender divide, but it's a divide over sort of broader, you know, perspectives on politics and you know, how workplaces are supposed to be structured and tradition versus change and all of that sort of stuff. And until there's sort of a common core of this is what we think is wrong and we can move forward from that, I'm not sure exactly what's going to culturally change over time.
Chris Ellis is an associate professor of political science at Bucknell University and director of Bucknell's Survey Research Laboratory. Karen Baker, chief executive director of Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape and the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. You're listening to WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I repeat that because it's a big part of what we are. Joining us is WITF's multimedia news director, Tim Lambert, to tell us about WITF's spring fundraising campaign.
That's right, and we are working our way towards a goal of $400 for Smart Talk, and we are making our way towards that goal with your help. If you just enjoyed a robust conversation about an issue that is front and center and has been for several months in the country, in the region, then hopefully that this is the kind of conversations, the kind of discussions about issues that you are counting on each and every day to hear from Smart Talk, to hear WITF bring you a diverse point of view, a diversity of voices, a way to help you be better informed as a citizen of Central Pennsylvania. And if you are listening more and more to the work we kick out each and every day for you, we hope that you'll become a financial contributor during the spring fundraising campaign. And we hope that you make that call now at 1-800-233-9483, or you can go online to WITF.org. It could be a $10 a month contribution. It could be a dollar a day contribution, that one-time gift of $365. Join Preston from Lebanon and Brian from Camp Hill and Ellen from York and Seth from Harrisburg and Lizzie from Harrisburg and Carolyn from Gettysburg, who are all part of the WITF family now. And your contributions, while public media is free to everybody, your contributions will help cover the cost of our programming, of our salaries, of the work we do each and every day for those who can't. So you are contributing to the community as well. 1-800-233-9483.
Tim, I think that's so important what you just said, contributing to the community, because that civil discourse, you know, we've talked on this program.
Does that exist anymore?
Well, that's just it. And it does here. It does here.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's part of civics overall and people being involved in the community. And that's what we encourage here at WITF, presenting the kind of information that we do, that you become, or not become, you probably already are, but encourage it even more, involvement in the community and thinking about the issues that are important that have an impact on your life or the lives of your family or other people's lives across the region, across the state, across the country. It is so important that you hear that full story and not just that headline, so that you can get the full context of what something really means. That is a big part of what we do here at WITF.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we make the decisions based on the local level here. We're locally owned and operated. I've said that a few times during this campaign, but it can't be emphasized enough, as there's been media consolidation over the years, and we've seen corporations come in and they buy up some media properties in central Pennsylvania, and then all of a sudden decisions are being made from on high about cuts to programming, cuts to staff, and things like that. So we are here. The decisions are locally owned and operated. We are making the decisions here in central Pennsylvania. Our board's made up of central Pennsylvanians, so we hope you support what we do at WITF.org.
You also could call 1-800-233-9483. Tim, thank you very much for being with us.
Anytime, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, chronic wasting disease in Pennsylvania's deer herd. It's beginning to become a real concern across the state. And also a little, maybe I should say, tiny Pennsylvania history. And you'll know what I'm talking about when you tune in to tomorrow's show.